Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone should has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts and in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly historically has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. Freedom of religion guaranteed in the Constitution has long been controversial. That is, various religions have disagreed with each other about the boundaries of religious freedom in the United States. Any government involvement with religion has brought hundreds of lawsuits over the years. And those who wish no religion at all in the public square have made their views clearly known on a regular basis as well. We're going to talk today about several cases that deal with how much religious freedom religious people have to project their own views in a public situation. Can you try to convert people to your faith on the streets or in public areas? Is it okay to hand out literature? Is it okay at a public high school graduation ceremony for it to be in a church? These are some of the issues that we're going to discuss today with Dan Barrett. Dan is the legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union in Connecticut. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about one of the cases that became a landmark Supreme Court case. It happened here in Connecticut, and it's an important case for a variety of reasons. It's called Cantwell versus Connecticut, and it has to do with whether or not you have the right as an individual religious person to offer your ideas about religion in a public place, in this case, a public street. The events happened in New Haven in 1940. Can you talk a little bit about this case and explain to us what happened and why it happened?
Sure. So the events in the case happened in 1938, but gestational periods of litigation being what they were back then, much shorter, it got to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1940. And in the case, I think it was Jesse Cantwell, who was the father, went out into a neighborhood in New Haven with his two sons to try to talk people into seeing religious faith their way, which was as Jehovah's Witnesses. And so Mr. Cantwell presented people he encountered on the street with a variety of written material about the world from the perspective of Jehovah's Witnesses, and he had a portable record player, which I think is a great detail from the case. And he would ask the people he encountered if he could play them one or more brief records that I'm given to understand were a sort of dramatic recitation or an oration about the subject matter of each pamphlet that he had to distribute to the person he encountered. And so he encountered a couple of people and asked them if he could play the records. They said, sure. And he did, the record was promoting a pamphlet that, as I understand it, was entitled Enemies. And it talked about how, from the perspective of the Jehovah's Witness approach to faith, organized religion is a barrier between oneself and God. And so one of the listeners perceived it as an attack on the Roman Catholic faith. In fact, I think both the listeners did. And one of them told him that he was very tempted to hit Mr. Cantwell with his fists, and another one told him that he was tempted to push Mr. Cantwell off the sidewalk or something of that nature. I mean, it sounds very genteel compared to today's world. And so Cantwell and his sons, they were all canvassing the same area. All three of them had the pamphlets, the phonograph, and the three of them were charged with a variety of offenses. But the two offenses...
By the police. The police were called into this confrontation.
Right. Exactly. The police showed up in New Haven, and the three of them were charged in what is now the Superior Court in New Haven with a variety of offenses, but it was really counts 3 and 5 that got the U.S. Supreme Court's attention. The third count was a common law count, and it had to do with solicitation. I'm sorry, it was a statutory count. It had to do with solicitation. It was a generalized prohibition against soliciting anywhere, I think, in the state, unless one had, prior to soliciting, obtained a permit from a state official. And the second count, which I think was count 5, was a common law count for breach of the peace. And the state's theory of the case was that Mr. Cantwell and his sons breached the peace by exposing the listener to information that would have caused the listener to breach the peace had they in fact carried out their threat to push him off the sidewalk or strike him with their fists. So after the conviction, they appealed to the state Supreme Court here in Connecticut, which was then called the Supreme Court of Errors. And from that, they took cert to the United States Supreme Court on the two counts.
Cert means what in this context?
In English, it means certification. So one can ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review. The U.S. Supreme Court only reviews issues of federal law. And so if there's a federal law issue that arises in a state court litigation, it can be litigated all the way to the court of last resort in the state, and then one can ask permission for the U.S. Supreme Court to review just the federal questions. That's what the Cantwells did, and they asked the Supreme Court to review the convictions on counts 3, the permit claim, and count 5, the public disturbance claim. And so that's what the court addressed in Cantwell.
So the question, if I can codify one part of it, there was a Connecticut statute that specifically said if you were going to solicit on the streets, you needed permission from a state official to do that, a license in effect to do that,
right,
or a permit.
Right.
And the Cantwells did not have one, and as I read the case, they believed that they should not need one because they were protected by the First Amendment and that they could distribute and talk about religious issues with the freedom of the First Amendment, and getting a permit was undue government interference in their rights.
Right.
Is that fair?
Yes, and I think what they, you know, I haven't gone back to the microfilm and found the briefs, but I think what they briefed and what the court decided is now really a question of discretion. In that, not just in the solicitation context, but in a number of other permit or licensing contexts, the First Amendment generally requires black and white rules. And the problem with the Connecticut statute that the Cantwells challenged was that it simply said that one had to go and get the permit from this state official. It didn't say how the official was to decide whether or not the permit should issue. And in effect, it was standardless. So you know, the Jehovah's Witness faith, it was and is, you know, numerically in the minority. And there was, I think, very sensible concern on the part of the court and probably anyone who reads the paper that, you know, religious minorities often are not treated very well. And so if you leave it to the open-ended discretion of a government official, you can really run into a problem wherein if the message itself is disfavored or the person is disfavored and there's no rules around how the permit should issue, then the danger is the government official will violate the First Amendment by using his or her views about the message to deny the permit. So that was the problem with the permit.
Views about the message being, in this case, if you don't like Jehovah's Witnesses' message, you might deny them a permit to solicit.
Sure, or if you have some kind of view that, you know, people shouldn't be out on the street telling other people about their religion, or you think, you know, I have to tell you that when you talk with government officials, or I should say when you depose them, you'd be surprised at the range of things that bother them. And so, for example, you know, I've spoken with some town clerks about election day registration here in Connecticut. We can show up at a polling place and register and vote on the same day. And a number of them have the view that anyone who does that is somehow disorganized and lazy, even though it's the law. It's just sort of bothersome. Like, what's the matter with you? You couldn't do this ahead of time. You know, so if it's standardless, you may run into this sort of thing where the official may think, well, what's the matter with you that you're going out and telling people about your faith? You should be at your job. So that's why and that part of Cantwell gets developed later in another series of cases about parade permits and that sort of stuff. But it was an important issue that they were raising. And I should also say that in the background, if you're really into the Bill of Rights, you might notice that, as far as I can tell, Cantwell is the first case that applies the First Amendment to a state. So it's the first case that what we call incorporates the Bill of the First Amendment to the Constitution against the states. So
states and towns,
right? States and their political subdivisions, because towns are merely a creature of the state.
And they considered that, if I remember correct, we can do more about this in a moment. But it's a 14th Amendment issue, I believe.
Right.
The Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. Let's go backwards a little bit from what you just said, because I think, from my experience, there are a lot of people who misunderstand the way the Bill of Rights works in the United States. We generally have majority rule. If you get 51% of the vote, you get to be mayor, president, governor, senator, whatever it is, town councilman. Majority rule is the generally accepted belief. What we often seem not to get, and I want your perspective on this, is that the Bill of Rights protects individuals and minority views, and in fact is designed as a protection against the majority in some cases. Is that fair to say?
Yes, although I would say if you were looking to locate the counter-majoritarian protections in the Constitution, it's not necessarily in the Bill of Rights, but it's in Article 3. And that sets out that the federal judiciary is a co-equal branch of government. It's the third branch. And that its members are appointed for life. And the precise reason why that was done was to ensure that they have some insulation and they have the ability to construe the law without needing to watch the polls. And so the rights in the Constitution, not just in the Bill of Rights, but some of the structural rights, some of the times when the courts are called upon to check one branch of the government against the other, all of that would be very, very difficult to do if the judges were elected. And I think you've seen that in the 35 state judiciaries in which judges are elected. Their results in election years tend to follow what you would expect from a politician. And so in federal land, I think those beautiful freedoms in the Bill of Rights would be virtually unenforceable without Article 3.
Okay. We're talking with Dan Barrett, who's the legal director of the ACLU in Connecticut. Let's go back to Cantwell. The Supreme Court eventually rules in this case, and it is considered a landmark decision. Why is it considered a landmark decision?
Well, that's probably open. Somebody smarter than me would probably give you 10 reasons why it's a landmark. I can think of three, one of which may not have been on the radar. The first, from my perspective, is the incorporation element, where the Supreme Court says, without much analysis, that the First Amendment, notwithstanding its text, applies to the states. If you read the First Amendment, it begins, as we all know, Congress shall make no law. Well, you may conclude from that language that means the second branch of government, Congress. It doesn't mean the states, because Connecticut has no Congress. We have a state house. We have a legislature. And so there was some debate as to whether or not the First Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights applies at all to the state. So for me, that's the first thing that Cantwell does. The second watershed thing that it does is the permit issue that we talked about. So that's a strain of law, the idea that permit issuance by the government should have some black and white rules of the road was new ground for the First Amendment. And the third issue, of course, is the question of, well, this question of what you might call the effect of speech upon a speaker being levied against, you know, the speaker himself. So the effect of the speech upon the listener, I should say, which is something that gets developed later, especially in the 60s. But at the time, it was revolutionary. The idea that simply because you're saying something that may upset somebody else doesn't mean that you yourself have violated the law or should be punished for it. If the other person acts out, it's on them to conform their behavior to the law, not the other way around.
And we should point out that the police arrested the Cantwells. They did not arrest the two men who threatened to hit them.
Exactly.
And that's the context in which we're talking about that.
Right,
in this,
yes.
In this case. There's another aspect of Cantwell that I think that we need to speak about, and that is this seems to have been decided, according to what the law books say, on a free exercise grounds. That is, there are two aspects, as you well know, of the First Amendment religious protections. One is the Establishment Clause, and the second is the Free Exercise Clause. Why is this a free exercise case and not an establishment case? And we'll talk about establishment just a moment with the second issue that we're going to discuss. But point out the free exercise issue a little bit.
Well, so I would say, so I now, with the benefit of however many years of hindsight, I'm not sure that I would classify, and, you know, I'm not a brilliant First Amendment mind, so it may be my failing. I'm not sure that I would say that the enduring legacy of Cantwell is free exercise. But if you wanted to look at Cantwell as a free exercise case, free exercise, as you say, is a small portion. It's one of the five freedoms in the First Amendment. And the nutshell version of it is that the government should not be able to restrict the practice of religion. There's a lot packed into that phrase. So there are obviously limits on what the government can do to restrict religion, but it means that if a person is out performing their religious duty, there are some rules that constrain the government on what it can do to somebody who's out performing their religious obligations. So, for example, free exercise prevents the government from disfavoring, let's say, Judaism, and saying, as some municipalities and states did in the bad old days, from saying that businesses must be open on Saturdays. They did that in order to make it difficult or impossible for adherent Jews to honor the Sabbath. And so that's a free exercise problem, because the government is preventing that person from exercising her religion in the way that she believes that she needs to do so.
We might also say that Cantwell has extended law in a number of parts of the country in relation to door-to-door solicitation, knocking on somebody's door and handing them a pamphlet, which used to also require a permit in many parts of the country. And what, in effect, this court case and some others did, if I understand it correctly, is say that's an infringement on the free exercise of religion, and you can't stop individuals who wish to proselytize their faith from knocking on doors.
Right. And so from Cantwell all the way up into the last of the door-to-door solicitation cases are in the 70s, and then they sort of died off. But the rough rule came to be that the municipality cannot, or the state can't say, you know, thou shalt not knock on anybody's door. The rule is that the homeowner is allowed, or the property owner is allowed, to put up a sign that says no solicitation. You know, it's common law tort rules. So the person is trespassing if they come onto the property despite the sign. But really, it's down to the person who answers the door. If they wish to not answer the door, that's fine. If they wish to open the door and say, I'm sorry, I don't want to talk to you about your religion, that's totally fine. That's how that tension gets resolved. It's not resolved by the government saying, you as a rule may not go door to door to spread your views.
Let's take on another aspect of government involvement in religion, and this one also occurred in Connecticut. And this has more to do with the Establishment Clause, as I understand it. In this case, a public school had been holding its commencement exercises in a church. It seemed to be a nice place to do it, and they'd been doing it for some time. And some people complained in the community that this was favoring that particular church's religion. And this offers a number of questions. Does the location engage with too much government involvement? Public school is a government activity. A church is a private activity. Is there too much entanglement with religion in this case? Tell us about the Enfield case.
Sure. So Enfield, you know, is a town that's up 91. It's right on the border with Massachusetts. It's a beautiful, you know, Connecticut River Valley town that used to be, maybe still is, a locus of tobacco farming since Europeans arrived in Connecticut. And it, for a number of years, had decided to hold, for reasons that are not clear, graduation, as you say, in a church down in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Not so far, it's just outside of Hartford. And in 2010, we filed suit, we the ACLU filed suit on behalf of a number of students and parents, because the school board in Enfield had decided, they had received some negative feedback after holding the graduations at this church in Bloomfield. And they had seemed to make a decision that they would no longer hold them in the church in Bloomfield. They were either going to rent Symphony Hall in Springfield, which it turns out is very close to Enfield, or a different venue, both of which had nothing to do with church. But then after what appeared to be some lobbying from the school board chair, whose view was, or at least appeared in the record to be, that somehow it was important for Enfield to imbue the graduation ceremony with the trappings of a religious setting, in 2010 they decided to hold the commencements at the church in Bloomfield. And so the problem with the venue, as you say, when we talk about the Establishment Clause, and I should say as a footnote, the Establishment Clause is kind of the other side of the Free Exercise Clause. The Establishment Clause says that the government is not going to establish any religion, which roughly means the government is not going to force anybody to practice a particular religion or not, or that the government's not going to put its thumb on the scale and exhibit a preference for one religion over another.
In fact, Madison and Jefferson argued in the process of creating the Bill of Rights and the First Amendment that the government being involved with religion could actually hurt religion in the long term.
Certainly, I think if you look at Europe and you know if you wanted to tear down organized religion in the United States, I think all you would do is make it a part of the government. If you look at Europe, you know, many countries have established state religions that are supported by taxpayer dollars, and that it engenders, in fact, quite a bit of resistance from the taxpayers themselves. So
actually, there's some Pew Charitable Trust polling on this, and it's really kind of interesting. This is kind of an aside, but it's also engaged with what we're discussing. The polling indicates that there are about 42% of people in France, Italy, England, who say they believe in a superior being and a god. And in the United States, it's up in the late, in the mid-80s. And the argument is that one of the reasons is that if you're forced to only support one faith, usually the Catholic Church in Italy and France, and usually the Anglican Church in Great Britain, you tend to reject that kind of pressure. Theoretical, but still interesting as far as the polling is concerned.
Well, and I think Madison, you know, aside from the idea of taxation, the founders had a pretty good view of what religion... So religion is a central and important part of our lives, or it can be. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. And in this country, it tends to be. But what they had seen, I suspect, was the long history in the European continent of what government-sponsored contests over religion had yielded, namely war. And so at a base level, they may have simply thought it was a way to keep us out of spending the enormous amount of time and money that had been spent on religious disputes and instead pour them into developing the country, which turned out to be a good bet.
We jumped away from the Enfield case by doing that little tangent.
Sure.
It's an interesting tangent. So let's go back to Enfield.
Sure. So Enfield, as I was saying, it's an Establishment Clause case. The basic claim is that by selecting the location that they did for the public high school graduation, that Enfield was effectively establishing a preference. They had expressed a preference for, in this case, the Christian faith. And as you mentioned, the Establishment Clause really looks to, in a nutshell, entanglement. So the idea is the government becoming too involved in religion or so involved as to express a preference for it? And the answer in Enfield, because of the facts, was yes, at least according to the preliminary injunction that was granted. The setting itself is what provided, the setting and some of the deliberations of the school district itself provided the record saying, yes, it's highly likely that they entangled themselves with religion. The building was peculiarly shaped. It was purpose-built as a very large church, seats about 3,000 people. So it's not, for example, a rectangular, low-slung, all-purpose auditorium that happened to be used as a church. It wasn't one of these storefront churches or something like that. It was purpose-built. On top, there was a, I think, 25-foot-tall crucifix. There were a number of very, very large crosses inside that were permanently affixed to the wall. There were motifs in the carpet. There were banners on the wall. There were pictures of deities. There were all kinds of things that would make it unmistakable to the average person, that is to say, the person who's coming to attend the graduation, that this setting was a church. And so that was really the problem with that venue.
There are a number of issues surrounding this, but let's say we wanted to make City Hall decorated in some way. So we'll simply put a Star of David on the roof, or we'll simply put a crucifix on the roof. Just because we want to respect a faith. That's an example of entanglement, yes? A public building may not have those kinds of displays.
That's right, yes. That's a very easy example of entanglement.
We're now taking a public school, a government entity, putting it into a church that's very clearly identified with religious purposes. And that's the entanglement issue in this case. What did the court say?
Right. So what the court did was follow the analysis that we use for entanglement. And so it looked at, you know, really nuts and bolts stuff. When the person drives up to the building, what do they see? How is it labeled? When they walk into the building, what do they see? That sort of like visual presentation. Because what the, in this context of a setting, what the court is trying to get to the bottom of is, how would a person understand this government function in this setting? And what they would see from the record in this case was that the school had decided to promote religion based on its choice. So it had made the conscious decision not to have this thing in Symphony Hall or a large auditorium or outside or something like that, but they had decided to say, this is the venue of our choosing, and it happens to be draped in articles of the Christian faith. And so an observer, a reasonable observer, would find that the government had decided to send a message to endorse that particular religious faith. And I think because of the setting, it was very difficult to escape that conclusion. This was not a large building that had, you know, a couple of religious items that could have been covered over with a sheet. This was purpose-built to be a church, and I've never been inside, but I'm sure it's beautiful. And so the violation in that case was the endorsement, the idea that the school had presented this to its graduating seniors and families and said, this is the right venue. We prefer this venue that happens to be very much draped in religion.
We are a country that has a majority of people who are Christian. I should say Christian in the broadest sense, because there are Protestants and Catholics and a large variety of Protestants and a smaller variety, but still a variety among Catholic practitioners. We are a majority Christian nation, but we are not a Christian nation in the sense that there are a lot of other faiths being practiced, and some of the parents and kids from that high school would very likely be either Jews or Muslims or Hindus or some other kind of faith that does not accept the crucifix and so forth. Is that the thrust of this?
That's right. The idea is, in fact, one of the plaintiffs was an agnostic. The idea is that if we keep government's thumb off the scale, so the government doesn't endorse a religion, it doesn't express any preference, we want to make sure what that does is maximally ensure participation in our government. So the student and the family don't get the message that they are lesser people, or that their accomplishment of graduating high school means something less, or that they're less welcome. Everyone gets to participate in the government proceeding on equal basis. And so no one needs to feel shut out or feel that their government is has sending the message that their personal beliefs and their faith are worth less or somehow wrong.
We're talking with Dan Barrett, who's the legal director of the ACLU in Connecticut, the American Civil Liberties Union. I want to just jump into a couple of other issues, if we may. But I'm kind of curious about a couple of other things. One of them is Griswold versus Connecticut. This is, again, a landmark case, happened to happen in Connecticut, had to do with the dissemination of birth control information and devices. Things as simple as condoms. This is back not that long ago. This case was decided in the
55 years ago, I think.
55 years ago. And it was there was a Connecticut law that prevented the distribution of things like condoms or even pamphlets, information about how to engage in contraception if you were a married couple. And Planned Parenthood became part of this case because they were some of the groups that were distributing this information. The case went all the way to the Supreme Court, and eventually it was decided that this prevention of the law itself, preventing distribution, was unconstitutional. We have, over a number of years, really for more than 100 years, been slowly expanding our understanding of what the First Amendment means in cases like Cantwell, Griswold, the church case that you were just talking about with the school, and a number of other circumstances. Is that fair to say we're having a broader understanding of what it means and fewer restrictions?
Yes. Well, with respect to speech, I think that's absolutely correct. If you go back and look at the turn of the last century for the Supreme Court, there really wasn't much of a concept of free speech. They were happy to affirm convictions for distributing literature and inciting riots and all sorts of things that would be completely lawful today. It wasn't really until like the 1940s that the court started getting into the idea that free speech means free speech. So I think you're right in that sense. And there's also a way in which the speech, well, all of the elements of the First Amendment in a sense draw on who we are and what we think, in a sense that we are allowed to express our inner thoughts out in the world in the way in which we choose to express them. And also, when you get into, you know, Griswold and some of the reproductive cases, really sort of there's a like an agency kind of concept that somehow we're allowed to direct our own, plan for our own lives and undertake things the way in which we intend to do them. And that's true of religion as well, that we have at our core, if you're a religious believer, that's a part of you that's integral. So yes, I think that's largely correct, that it has expanded. The question with religious practice, really with free exercise, that's the area in which you're getting into the question of how expansive is expansive enough and how expansive do we get before one person's free exercise begins to perhaps intrude on another's. But I think you're right. And largely it's because, as I say, the Supreme Court, it sort of forgot about at least the speech aspect until the 1940s. And then all of a sudden they woke up and said, oh, well, it says here.
Congress shall make no law.
Right. And that means one thing.
Okay, we've been talking with Dan Barrett, legal director of the ACLU in Connecticut.
Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh Labella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.